his hero name is Ozymandias. Damn it. What did we say?
Ozymandias?
Ozymandias, damn it.
Hello and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast made with friendship, feelings, and snark. I'm Nicole Sweeney.
My name is Marines.
And we are joined today by Garrett Robinson.
Hi, I'm Garrett Robinson. I'm a fantasy author and publisher. I write diverse epic fantasy with a number of other authors in a universe called Underrealm. If you want to check out the books, you can find them at underrealm.net. If you want to listen to my fiction podcast, you can find it on all podcast services, and it's called the Nightblade Epic Podcast. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for joining us. We actually invited Garrett here today to talk about Watchmen, which you guys probably knew by the title of this podcast. And I'm going to give you guys my best go at a synopsis here with the warning that I might mispronounce all of these names. So here we go. We start in an alternate dystopian 1985. And in this world, masked vigilantes were once championed by society and are now outlawed by the Keen Act, which also forced these vigilantes to reveal their true identities. Two exceptions are made. One is Dr. Manhattan, who is the only hero in the story with actual powers, which he obtained through a freak radiation accident. And the second is the comedian, who works with the government specifically as kind of like a mercenary. So he's helping them in combat. Through their help, the U.S. wins the Vietnam War. Nixon is still president, and there are major technological advances years and years ahead of what we see them in our nonfiction world. So at the start of the graphic novel, kind of the inciting incident is that the comedian is brutally murdered. Rorschach, who wears a mask with an ink blot on it, he has refused to reveal his identity and continues to act outside of the law, and he starts investigating the comedian's death, convinced that somebody is attacking the ex-heroes. Next, we see that Dr. Manhattan is accused of causing cancer in those closest to him, so he puts himself in timeout on Mars. next, someone tries to kill Adrian Voight, also known as Ozymandias. Someone tries to shoot him while he's at his office. So Rorschach questions Moloch, who is a now retired criminal and was the comedian's arch enemy. And Moloch admits that the comedian did come see him before his death, but he was drunk and rambly, so Moloch doesn't really know anything. Except later, he gets back in touch with Rorschach and schedules a meeting, but it all turns out to be a trap. Moloch is dead. Rorschach is arrested for his murder, and he is unmasked. Lori, once known as the Silk Spectre, an identity that she inherited from her mother, was dating Dr. Manhattan, but they broke up right before his Mars timeout, so she ends up crashing at Dan's place, and his former hero thing was Night Owl. So they spend some time thinking about like days of yore, and they eventually like jump back into the crime fighting kind of on a whim, kind of as a precursor to Sexy Times. I don't know, something was happening there. Dan can't stop thinking about who might be out there trying to kill them, and he decides that they need to break Rorschach out of jail. Dr. Manhattan comes back and takes Lori to Mars so they can have some deep chats. In the meanwhile, Night Owl and Rorschach follow all of the clues, and it leads them to Ozymandias. Why can't I get that?
Yeah, you got it. You got it.
It leads them to Ozymandias. He was doing the murdering, and he also exposed people to radiation that caused the cancer that was blamed on Dr. Manhattan. So they have their big confrontation in his secret hideout in Antarctica, where Adrian reveals his violent plans for world peace. It involves like a fake alien invasion, I guess, and it kind of works too. So all of the heroes agree that they should keep the truth to themselves, but Rorschach doesn't agree. He thinks people deserve to know the truth. So Dr. Manhattan kills him and then runs away to another galaxy. Dan and Lori continue their relationship, and Adrian disappears forever. And then later in New York, an editorial assistant discovers Rorschach's journals, leaving us on a kind of dun dun dun. And I think that's it.
Such a happy tale.
Yeah. So we usually start with, did you like it? But I kind of want to take a step back and, Garrett, ask you about your background with Watchmen and like when you first read the book, like what your sort of history with it is. and maybe go from there into did you like it?
Yeah. So I first read Watchmen right around the time the movie came out. I actually can't remember now if I read it before or after the movie, but I heard about the movie. The trailer looked super awesome and I was very excited for it. So I think that I ran and grabbed it from Borders. I think they were still around back then.
Oh man, yes, they were. Probably like one of the last sales at Borders. Yeah.
I think I was the last. I think they threw me a celebration or a funeral. But and then I read it. So that's when I read it. And I've had it around since then. I lost it moving at some point since then. But I went and I ordered a new copy this week. And I read it pretty much in one sitting. Not entirely, because I have a wife and three kids. So like you never get to do anything in one sitting. But so I feel like that rolls into did you like it? Because my answer is, I don't think that Watchmen is intended to be liked. I don't know that you're supposed to enjoy reading this story. It's very dystopian. It's very dark, very violent and everything like that. But it is compelling as hell. I stayed up until 2:30 a.m. Reading it. So I think that it is a really, really good story that just kind of really grabs you and doesn't let go until you finished it.
So I think I also tried to read this when I saw the trailer come out, but I picked it up. I want to even say it was from the library, like an old, if you've ever seen like graphic novel library copies, they're all beat to shit. So this is like an old gross copy. I DNF'd it. I couldn't get into it at the time and I never went back. So I turned back to it. I never watched the movie either. I feel like I started that and DNF'd it too. So something about it, just like the story didn't really grab me. And my experience with reading it now was that like a hesitant yes that I liked it, but it is very much that idea of like not necessarily enjoying it. This is not a happy story. And I think my main like quibble, I am very much a person that for the most part characters are my entry point into a story, and there wasn't any specific character here that I could really latch onto. So for a while it was difficult for me to get into the story until we had enough of a buildup of the world and the stakes and the plot where I was like, okay, now I'm interested. So it was a little bit of slow going for me, but in the end I'm happy I read it, I guess, because I think that this is a really interesting piece of media and I think it'll be great to discuss it.
So I just read the book for the first time this past week in preparation for this podcast recording. I definitely saw the movie in theaters, but like forgot about it after that. This book that I read is a physical copy that I have had in my possession for a decade now. I say that because I didn't buy it. A friend lent it to me in college.
Oh my God.
Oh no. Oh no.
And I've been holding on to it for 10 years now. So anyway, I gotta reach out to my friend, see if she wants me to ship her book back. That's a separate thread here. Answering the did you like it question, I'm glad that Garrett prefaced his did you like it in that way, because I do think that the did you like it question is very tricky with this particular piece of media. And I'm really, really torn because I definitely did not enjoy all of the experiences that the book did not want me to enjoy. They had their intended effect. But I think I still just generally didn't like it beyond that. But I think it's really interesting and I'm really excited to talk about it. And I don't regret having read it. I don't see myself ever going back and rereading it. So again, gotta find my friend, try to get it back to her if she wants it or donate it. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to this physical copy. I definitely don't see myself rereading it because I had some problems with it above and beyond the things that I think it wanted me to sort of struggle with. I do think there are a lot of really interesting ideas here, and I'm excited to talk to you guys about all of that.
I think it's really interesting, jumping off of what Mari said in Did You Like It, not connecting to the characters, right? So at the beginning of this story, there are a bunch of characters introduced to you pretty quickly, and not a single one of them has a motivation except for Rorschach, who is just the worst. He's the worst.
He sucks, yes.
And so what one criticism that I do have of Watchmen isn't really a criticism of Watchmen, but it's that it has a really hardcore Fight Club phenomenon where you're not supposed to like Rorschach. He's supposed to be like the worst, and there is a whole like fandom surrounding him where it's just like, oh, he's so cool, and he's the worst. He's maybe like objectively, you know, state of the universe, the worst person in the story except for the comedian. And at the same time, at the beginning of the story, he's the only person who's trying to do anything, and that's the only kind of character that you can really connect to. So he's the most interesting, and I get why that makes him so endearing to so many fans out there. And it's not until much later in the book that all of a sudden characters are like, oh no, I want to do these things, and then they're also not awful people and they don't have awful goals, and then you can find yourself latching onto them, right?
Right. Rorschach, I think, was a big struggling point for me, because reading this now for the first time in 2019, I could definitely detect the degree to which, I don't know, like douchey white boys who think their nihilism makes them interesting could latch onto this character, you
yes.
know, like in this way. Again, the Fight Club phenomenon, as you put it, where there is a conflict between what is being presented and kind of the ways that people are reading it. It reminds me of Emily Nussbaum's piece in The New Yorker a few years ago about the bad fan phenomenon and like All in the Family and Archie Bunker, and how he is supposed to be this character that you look at and are like, no, like he's saying things that are terrible, but many people watched the show and they were like, oh, I love that guy. He tells it like it is. And that sort of conflict between what you set out to create and how people read it, and, you know, who then is responsible for that, I don't really know. That's like a complicated sort of question that I don't want to try to answer here, but it was a thing that struck me a lot while I was reading it.
Yeah.
I think it would have been really interesting to be consuming this like when it was new. Mm-hmm. I think I would have enjoyed it, or again, enjoy air quotes. I would have appreciated it a lot more if I weren't coming to it now at this particular moment in time.
Totally. And this is a great example of in a lot of cases like this, where a piece of media has the Fight Club phenomenon on it, there is some ambiguity about what the creator was trying to intend. And like, very fortunately, that is not the case with Watchmen. Like, this was created by Alan Moore, and he's very explicit and has been explicit out of the book of like what his intention was.
Right.
So like, I think having that conversation, like you were saying, when it was happening, and you could have brought up like the discussions that he was having around the same time, just would have been a very unique reading experience. But I think it came out in like, what, 86 or something like that?
I think, well, the full volume or whatever, I think is like 87, but yes, yeah. 86, maybe 86, 87, somewhere in there.
Yeah, so I was a year old, so that wouldn't have been an option for me. Yeah.
I was not born yet, so yeah. Also could not have had that.
We talked about this when we started watching the new Star Wars movies, but this idea of like coming to something backwards, and how Star Wars, you know, really established a lot of things for the genre. Like, I can see how this was groundbreaking when it came out, but in like a period of time where there's oversaturation, I think, of superhero stories, and now there's been so much like superheroes but dark, like
right.
That is a whole thing that has happened. And
right.
even with Rorschach, where, you know, I can see where they were trying to gray him very, very obviously, but I think that because of oversaturation, like, it played a little bit differently. So everything about like, he killed a dog, but then it's revealed that he killed a dog because a little girl was kidnapped, and, you know, like, I don't know, the way that they were trying to muddy the waters there about Rorschach being a bad guy, but not really. It just, in 2019, I don't want it. Like, I don't want it. I don't want that story.
But that's funny, because I don't read Rorschach as particularly gray, and I don't feel like Alan Moore wanted him to be. But I feel like that might be a phenomenon of the oversaturation, because
ooh,
so many Rorschach lookalikes are grayed in their stories, and they're given that
sure.
nuance and that, like, well, what about this aspect? And I don't think that was an intention in the storytelling. I think that might be something that we're bringing back to 1987. Uh-huh. If that makes mm-hmm. sense, you
yes.
know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Alan Moore's whole point in Watchmen was, hey, we all talk about how cool it would be if superheroes existed in real life, but if they did, they would suck. They would all be the worst people, and they would be so bad for society as a whole. Like, that's the point of the book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Rorschach does not do well under any kind of lens other than he looks really cool in the movie. And of the people who have completely like misunderstood Watchmen through the years, I think it's fair to say that Zack Snyder is very close to the top of the list.
That is a really interesting point too, though, about the way in which, like, reading this in 2019, we are imposing some of 2019 onto the reading of it that I hadn't really thought about. I think I would say in my case, I would like say that goes double for just being a person who doesn't read a lot of comic books in general, and especially superhero stories. Presentations of good and evil are probably a little bit like more clearly delineated, and like I am probably projecting a lot more of that gray baggage onto it because of the other media that I am consuming that like maybe wasn't right. ever intended to be in this particular piece of media.
Yeah, and you're so right too that this was so established so many things for the genre, because yeah, you do see the moral gray creeping into superhero stories, which used to be Captain America punches Nazis, right? It's
right,
like
right.
It used to be so much like that this was not the start, but certainly a very formative piece and of making superhero stories much more gray. And when that happened, you saw it bleeding into so much other media, because so much media is created by nerds, and we nerds read lots of comics, so they sort of bring that into such things as, yeah, George R. R. Martin, huge nerd, and has talked about and loves comics and all that sort of thing. And I mean, you know, talk about the king of trying to make the most awful, repugnant people at least somewhat morally redeemable, and succeeding or failing depending on how you look at it.
I want to go back to this thing about the time that this came out, and again, none of us lived through this particular historical moment, so maybe maybe we're not the right people to be bringing this up, but I do think it's really interesting to remember that this is coming out at the tail end of the Cold War, and
right.
like at sort of the final moments of kind of big uncertainty about the way all of that was going to go. And you feel that, like, that's like, that is also a very palpable driving force in this book. And one of the things that I really, really enjoyed is the way that it plays with the alternate histories, you know, of assuming, okay, this is the moment in time where we introduce these heroes. And then, you know, from this point forward, we're going to start nudging blocks a little to the left, you know, whatever, all the way up to the point in which this book is taking place. And I think yeah. that is super, super interesting. But the atmosphere, the sort of intense, like, looming threat of nuclear war that like permeates the book, I think it is important to, again, remember when it actually came out and to sort of contextualize it in that way.
Right. And there's that line by I think it's actually by the comedian in the book where he's talking with, if I'm not mistaken, oh shoot, I actually can't remember who he's talking with. But he basically says, God, can you imagine if we'd lost Vietnam? I think this country kind of would have gone a little bit crazy. And you look at it from their perspective and you think, oh, I can imagine how in their situation, yeah, you can imagine the country going crazy if you'd lost Vietnam. But we live in the timeline where we did lose Vietnam. And after that, it never looked as bad as it looks in this comic.
Right.
Like, this comic is so much worse than our real world was. And yet they're like, well, things may suck, but at least we didn't lose Vietnam. And you're uh-huh. like, oh, my, that's really clever world play and world building and like not. Nods to the reader, and it does a lot to redeem one of the things that struck me as over the top in the book, which is the transitions, where it's just like, you know, you'll have two scenes cutting back and forth between them, and it's like, well, it looks like we're coming to the end now, and then it shows like a panel that is like very, very obviously like the end of the other scene. Those transitions, you see them in comics all the time, but like it was really over the top on this reread. And I kept finding myself getting distracted by like little technical things like that. And then the story kept, and the way that he would play with the alternate timeline and the way he would play with superhero tropes and what they mean in social consciousness just like kept bringing me back to like, oh no, this is, God, this is actually really well done, you know?
I think that idea of being like, well, you know, things suck, but at least blah, blah, blah. That is just like a very human thing, I think.
Right.
The way that you have to rationalize that kind of stuff and think that, I don't know. I had kind of like a crisis as I was writing my synopsis, and I wrote something about like in this alternate timeline, something happening, but in our real world, like our nonfiction world. And I was like, I don't know, man, maybe this is the fiction world. but yeah, that idea of like, you know, adapting to your reality and having to make those connections or those rationalizations of, you know, things could be worse, I thought was very clever as well, because it just felt very human. It was something that helped me connect to the story, where a lot of times that was not coming by way of the characters.
Yeah, in the writing world, dystopian fiction is huge right now. And for, I mean, we've always written and told and filmed stories about, boy, imagine how much worse the world could be. And I feel like for some people, maybe a lot of people, maybe a plurality of people, it feels like the world we're in right now is like so bad that we have to actually imagine like full scale nuclear or zombie apocalypse to have a story that's set in a world that's worse than ours. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I feel like he was tapping into that. I feel like people were so frightened in the 80s with Vietnam and the Cold War and everything either still going on to some degree or in very, very recent memory, that he was like, hey, It literally could be worse. And even if it was, we'd still be going, oh my God, imagine how much worse it could have been. Like, I think that's a very important message to the whole story.
And that not only did he say it could be worse, he said superheroes is what would have made it worse. I really I enjoy that. I love that idea that like the thing that you are imagining could save you from this. No,
it would not be the thing.
Right. I read that apparently the HBO show is going to be set in the present, which I think is really interesting because this feels so deeply contextualized in its time. On the one hand, it seems strange to me to do that, but on the other, one of my biggest problems with the story is its like tremendous failures in terms of representation. And so I suspect part of making that decision to move it to now is maybe to address some of that, maybe like do right by some of its female characters, like, I don't know, have more than two people of color in your book, like whatever. Maybe that is some of where we're going to correct that by setting it now. But it seems very, very strange to me because of how much of this is situated in this very particular moment in time. Even though it's an alternate history, it's an alternate history of like a very precise moment.
And one that's very well known about and very well rooted in what actually did happen and has been studied so heavily that you can change a few of the pieces in the chessboard of history and still see what play you're on right now. But because even in the comics, the appearance of Dr. Manhattan didn't fundamentally change the worldview of the entire planet. It heavily affected one area of international relations. Mm-hmm. But the end of the book fundamentally changes the worldview of the entire planet. So how are you now going to bring that another 40 years forward into the future and think that you can predict what it's going to look like with a degree of accuracy? I'm not super hopeful for the series, because I also think that if you greenlight a series like this, it's more because of the cult following of the movie as opposed to the book.
Right.
And like I said, movie compared to book, I don't know how much we want to discuss that, but
I think it's really interesting to to think about like the when this was set and then having something set in present time, because for all of the pieces that felt a little bit dated as I was reading, there was a lot of things also that just coming at it from 2019, you can't escape like a lot of the comparisons that happened between like Trump and Nixon and Watergate and, you know, Russia being prominent in the news again. And so even though like, you know, yes, rolling that alternate history forward all of these years and whatnot and trying to really decide how all of that has an effect, even reading it now, like the parallels are there in a sort of weird way from our current history to this alternate history. So I don't know. It just was something that struck me even as I was reading it and thought that some things, you know, it was more difficult to really attach to because it felt a little bit dated to me.
Yeah. And in the Watchmen universe, Nixon gets a third term. That changes America. And how does that play out? You know, so after that, does everybody do it? Or does Congress like try to pass a law after that? Or like how do you, it's going to be really hard for them to unroll that and have it feel super, super real and as grounded as the story does. But I guess we're going to see. I like, on any sort of nerd media, I want it to be good. You know what I mean? I always want it to be good and successful. But at the same time, sometimes I'm just like, oh.
Probably not.
I understand that there are a lot of really interesting ideas here that can be played with. But I also think, I don't know, there are things about this story that now in 2019 are like kind of regressive and like maybe just leave those things there and borrow from the ideas that are interesting and like make something new. I don't understand.
I mean, you know, that's the question of like all pop media these days.
I do want to talk about these more regressive pieces of this. There are several places to go, but I think the thing that puts this solidly in the I did not like it camp, the thing that I really truly cannot forgive this story for is the rape plot. Yeah. Everything about the way that this story handled that plot was just deeply upsetting.
The worst.
Yeah. And it is a thing that made it really difficult for me to connect with all of the interesting things that the story was trying to say, or maybe questions it was trying to pose about humanity, when the book feels so disinterested in my own humanity, right? Like,
right.
It was just like, cool. The interview with Sally, that sort of like interstitial section, and I guess we can bring that back around to something that I did enjoy, which is a lot of these kind of like meta books within the book. But the interview with her was just like deeply upsetting. And it was, again, the kind of upsetting that isn't just it wasn't something that I feel like the story was trying to show me something dark and complicated and force me to look at it. It felt just careless. And it felt like the story was being really cavalier and unthinking with this rape narrative. The language that she was using was really upsetting. And then it felt almost like they doubled down on it, because the moment where Lori finally connects the dots and realizes who her dad is was mostly just there for John to decide that he was going to, you know, check back in with humanity. Like that, even that moment wasn't really about Lori. And it was just, I don't know, everything about it was intensely frustrating, and it was interspersed throughout the book just enough that it was like, anytime I could sort of feel myself getting back into it, I would be like hit in the face by the story with this reminder that I didn't enjoy.
Yeah. And it's very true where it affects John a lot. I don't see any indication in the story that after the initial realization and, you know, like almost throwing up on Mars, I didn't see any indication in the book that later on it changed anything about Lori, even, you know, who's not even the person it happened to, but doesn't change her relationship with her mom, doesn't really seem to change her viewpoint on the way things work in the world or what she's trying to do or anything like that. And it certainly didn't have, you know, her realization and whatnot didn't really have any effect on her mom, who remained another static character through the whole story. So it's just, it's not good. It's not great.
Another layer of it, like being super frustrating and annoying to me, was that so many times when you have dystopian worlds, you know, shorthand for how dystopian is it is like, how badly are your women treated? How many boobs are in the comic, and who got raped? And it just really honestly is like that like easy, cheap way to say things are real bad because this woman got raped, or, you know, all of the sexualization of women and women's bodies, even in the background of this, of the comic book, was really, really just unpleasant to read. And it existed solely to world build. So we knew just what a bad timeline we were in.
Right.
And I just think that's cheap storytelling. You can, I'm positive that you can build a world in a timeline without falling back on that. And then you're sort of noticing this as you read through the beginning, and then they hit you with the rape and you're like, oh, well, that's pretty bad. And then you keep reading, and then it's like, but wait, people are complicated and she had a relationship with a rapist. And you're like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's where this story went. So it's just like layer upon layer. And so what started as a bad taste in your mouth really just like evolved into full blown no thank you.
It's not only that it's lazy world building, it's also a question of who is usually using this tactic as a way of building a bad world. And like, it is the way in which male writers so frequently are cavalier with violence against female bodies in ways that I'm like, you seem like you don't entirely understand the frequency of this kind of violence in the actual world in which you live. Like,
right.
you're trying to tell us that this is some other world using a social phenomena that you don't actually understand in your current world. And like, that's the thing about it too, that it's like, it's not like it's cheap in that it's done a lot. It's also cheap that it is often used by people who don't really understand it.
Like, look how bad things could be. And it's like, well, but
hello,
but
still happening.
Yes.
And I think that goes to even the most charitable interpretation, the most charitable reading that you can give to that subplot, which is more saying, hey, you know, like, if we had a world in which superheroes existed, we would lionize them and deify them so much that they could get away with this stuff. And again, it's like, but they do. And they don't even have to be superheroes.
Right.
They get away with it all the time, every day.
And even that reading is hard for me to buy, again, because we have Sally forgiving him. Because the narrative goes out of its way to create a space for Sally to say, oh, well, it's complicated. That piece of it makes any sort of generous reading of it feel tricky for me to buy into, because... like, why? Why is that there?
You know what's not... Well, I actually want to know if you you agree, but what's not bad in all ways for all the reasons is the book within the book narrative.
Yes, yes. Oh, I loved it. I love it
so much. Oh, gosh, I love that comic within the comic. It's just, it's really good, and it's just hitting you right in the face. It's like, by the way, and I'm so sad about this because I can't refer people to, I saw some film YouTuber talking about the comic within the comic, and I saw this years and years ago, and they gave the best talk on it and the best explanation and the breakdown of all the themes and what specific panels relate to what other specific panels and how they tie together. It's the most incredible thing. Can't find it. I spent like 3 hours yesterday looking for this video so that I could tell people about it. Cannot find it. But it is the theme of the whole book, right?
It's funny though, because I stand by my hearty agreement that it's great, but I actually didn't think you were talking about the comic book. I thought you were referring to the multiple sort of books that we get in between chapters in the book, which is also something that I thoroughly enjoyed. Though I do agree, the comic book within the larger book is great, especially because of everything that the story is doing with superheroes. 100%, that was totally great. I just really appreciated, though, the in between chapter sort of sections of you know,
book excerpts, basically.
Book excerpts, basically. Yes, yes.
Yeah. I was hot and cold on those. Some were really good and really cool. Some were such a chore, and I would get to them and I would be like, oh no.
Can I skip this?
I have to confess that because I was kind of on a time crunch, I did skip Dan's bird chapter.
Oh my God, it's the worst thing in the whole book.
And I was was like, no, I refuse. I will not.
But what I thought was amazing about that is I love when, and I have totally stolen this in my own books, I love when writers take characters in their stories and make them awful writers. Because you just get to sit down and be like, oh God, his writing is going to be so bad. And you almost can't read it. It's so bad. It's so bad and tedious.
The larger view for me is that even though, yes, the bird chapter totally skipped it as well, and there were things like that that were a little more like, you know, on purpose, badly written or whatnot, I think the whole view for me is that I enjoyed how the work played with format.
Yes.
And that includes the comic within the comic. And I even really enjoyed, I know it is a little bit ham-fisted, but it does this thing where it repeats a lot of different like imagery, or it repeated a whole section where it was like the same captions or words again, but just kind of overlaid over different action or thing. It will like mimic, it will cut in and out of between the panels, like two different scenes. And so you're getting like the, let's say, the bits and pieces from the comic within the comic, but you're also seeing panels that pertain to the actual storyline, and all of that, like jumping back and forth, while it was a little in your face and a little bit, you know, obvious, I loved it. I really enjoyed the way that it kind of very much tied in all of the pieces that it was like trying to tie together. So where in other work, some of the like ham-fisted themes, you know, doesn't necessarily work for me, it did work for me here.
Yeah. And I think the one reason that it kept pulling me back in is because he hits you in the face with the first layer. And while you're still like blinking in, oh my God, then you start to realize that even beyond the first layer of subtext, or what I think it actually is like recontextualizing, there is another layer behind that and another one. Like, he hit you with it really hard to get you to pay attention. And then while you were looking at it going, oh my God, are you kidding me? Wait. Oh, like, you know, there was always something else and something else he was saying with that whole method. And again, it is something that is so ubiquitous in comics that, and in comics, when they're trying to do it seriously, they try not to make it look so ham-fisted. But if you're a really good, if you're used to the format, if you're familiar with storytelling and writing, you see it anyway when they're trying to make it subtle. And so he just doesn't even bother. He hits you in the face with it and then adds the subtlety in underneath that. It's a really well done comic. Like, it's just, it's really got some, it's got some depth. It's got some stuff to say. It has some parts that are less than ideal, but yeah.
Yeah. Even as I was struggling through it for various reasons, the things that I didn't like about it, I was continually struck by how well constructed it is,
right.
And both in terms of all of these things that it's doing in terms of playing with form and just, you know, the overall story. Like, I think it is a very well-assembled story. Maybe wasn't for me.
I know you mentioned a couple times, I cannot speak to this because I have not watched the movie, but you've brought it up and like groaned about it a little bit a couple times. So I just want to know specifically what your feelings about the movie adaptation were, or like where it failed in general terms.
I can refer people to a YouTube video on this one. I really think if you don't know who Movie Bob is, you should go find his channel, and he did a 3-part video series about Batman v Superman and why it's so bad. He really dislikes the movie. And I have not seen Batman v Superman. It did not appeal to me. I heard it was awful. I didn't, whatever.
I watched it for a podcast about bad movies. So,
oh boy.
And can confirm it was a solid fit.
So he made 3 separate hour-long videos about why Batman v Superman was so bad. And he was as charitable as he could possibly be, especially when it came came to Zack Snyder himself, because Zack Snyder is a good filmmaker at what he does. And obviously he makes some bad ones. And there was a whole complicated set of reasons why. I mean, he explained it for 3 hours why Batman v Superman turned out the way that it did. But in the third video, there's a 20-minute section in the middle where he just talks about Zack Snyder and essentially his worldview. And Zack Snyder is a, like, proud objectivist, like an out-and-out Ayn Rand lover and supporter. And he's been trying to get his film adaptation of The Fountainhead greenlit for more than a decade. Like, this is who we're dealing with.
I did not know this.
And when he sees someone like Rorschach, who is hated and despised by the commies and the socialists and the all of the various, slurs that he refers to people as. I mean, he hits every single ism. He's racist. He's sexist. He's homophobic. He's everything. But he's so misunderstood by society, and he's operating beyond the law because he knows with the pure integrity of the human soul and dignity what's right and wrong in the world, and he refuses to bend. And Zack Snyder basically makes the movie make Rorschach look like the coolest person on the planet.
Ooh.
And as, like, yeah, and as Lindsay Ellis, like, often talks about, yeah, there is still the text. Yeah, Rorschach is occasionally still sexist and misogynistic and homophobic and all these things. But film language is as important or more important than the words that they're saying. And when every single time you film him, he looks so cool and so awesome, and you tone down the aspects of his personality that, you know, the audience is going to find make him less endearing, you make it so much easier for the Fight Club phenomenon to happen.
Right.
And so that is, but you see that, take that as a microcosm and apply it to the whole movie. And that's kind of what it's like. Zack Snyder does see the superheroes as the coolest people ever. Like, in the movie, Silk Spectre and Night Owl basically have superpowers. It's not explicit about it, but they seem to have super speed and super strength. Like, Silk Spectre kicks a guy into a trash dumpster in a back alley, and the dumpster bends inward. Like, a person can't do that. So there's lots of stuff like that. And also the ending of the movie is changed so that instead of throwing in the extra dimensional creature into the middle of Manhattan and using its psychic shockwave to, like, kill half the city, Ozymandias makes it look like Dr. Manhattan reached down from Mars and nuked half the city. So it makes Dr. Manhattan to be the force that the planet needs to unite against. And then he is essentially exiled from the planet by the ungrateful people who can't worship or appreciate him enough to make it worth his while to save them. That's the single big gripe with the movie. Really well shot, beautiful, cool fight scenes, cool action. But when you take the point of the book and twist it that bad, I mean, that is the worst butchering of a film's message since Ender's Game. Like, I don't know what to say.
The thing about the powers is really interesting, to bring it back to the book, because I do not really remember the movie. My recollection of it is sort of non-existent. Periodically, while I was reading the book, I would have a vague flash of memory of, like, oh yeah, sort of remember seeing this, but that's kind of the extent of it. But the thing with the powers I thought was super interesting. Like, I thought it was an interesting choice to have the introduction of sort of superheroes be people without powers,
right?
Accepting that world, accepting the world where you have sort of masked vigilantes, but then and after people have gotten to a place that they accept that this is the world that they live in, then introducing the idea of, no, wait, like, there are also actually people with wild superpowers.
I think that it is a much more interesting premise. I feel like when you start with the scenario in the book at the beginning of the book, you've got, okay, so superhero comics come out and people decide to go be superheroes even without powers, and it makes everything messed up and worse and whatnot. And then you give a couple of them actual powers, because Ozymandias doesn't have, like, super speed or whatever, but he kind of does. Like, he meditates so hard that he becomes superhuman. Like, he can catch a bullet. Like, wow. So then you give a couple of them actual superpowers, and look how much worse it's going to get. It's an intensification of the main idea and theme of the book, right? Again, when you remove that and take that away, you lose that whole point. You lose that whole message. And by then also, the movie had no comic within the comic. So you take that away, and then you lose the theme and the message of the decision that you are the only one who can right the wrongs of society is going to turn you into an inhuman monster, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. the whole point of the comic within mm-hmm. the comic, is his desire for revenge and his certainty that he has been wronged and he has to go right wrongs with physical violence turns him into an inhuman monster who can no longer exist in society. It turns him into, it turns him paranoid, and it turns him violent and makes him, you know, hurt the people that he loves. Like, that. So there's three layers of message that you've just kind of thrown out the window when you take away those, like, those central elements of the book.
Because individualism.
Right. Exactly. Because individualism. That's the thing. I feel like we haven't actually talked much about Night Owl. What do you guys think about Night Owl?
It's hard for me to think about, like, the feelings that I had for individual characters. I don't have any strong feelings toward Night Owl one way or the other. I think that I was lost a lot more in the things like the format, the message, the world building. And then by the time that we got to Night Owl and his, like, relationship with Lori, I had a bad taste in my mouth about Lori, the way that her character was handled.
Yes.
And to
yes.
see her,
right.
like, jumping to the Night Owl relationship was just kind of like, I don't want it. I don't want this either.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of colored and tainted, I guess, my perception of Night Owl as a whole. And you're asking the question made me realize, like, huh, I didn't really think about him much, like, outside of that.
Yeah. By the time that we get to that romantic plot, it felt very much like Night Owl was your sort of classic capital N, capital G nice guy. And Lori was this prize that he had won. And everything about that, coupled with my general frustrations with the way that the only major female character is handled, didn't incline me to care about him, but for reasons that were less about this character than where his development came in the story. Like, by the time we
right.
get to fleshing out his character, it was happening at a time when I was like, I don't care about you at all.
I mean, he's definitely the book's most obvious Batman parallel, right? Their
right.
costumes are not dissimilar. He's got a bat cave. He's rich, and he's got all of his gadgets because he's rich. And that's basically his entire superhero persona. And what he doesn't have from Batman is, I've stared directly into the heart of evil. And it blinked first, you know, because that's already been given to Rorschach. So you
right.
can't have it in Night Owl. What exactly was Night Owl supposed to say? You know, what was that character existing in that story supposed to say? Is it saying, hey, listen, if Batman didn't growl and break people's arms, none of you would like him. There's nothing cool or interesting about this guy except that you all want to be badasses. So I'm going to show you what, like, you know, what you call badasses. So I'm going to show you what that would really look like. His name is Rorschach. He's the worst person in the world. And when you take that away from Batman, you've got this, you know, dumpy guy who just can't really do or motivate or move anything forward in the story. I don't feel like that's a good enough read based on how much layer there is in the rest of the book.
I think that what we see in the characters is like a you know, different variations of how power corrupted them. And I think that because he has like the whole nice guy thing, but there are still an element of how power corrupted him, or how putting on the mask changed his life, or,
yeah.
you know, how he wasn't ever necessarily able to bounce back from that. And that would have been like a fine thing to say. Like, he's still generally a nice guy, even though this, the same way that it changed everybody, it changed him as well. But they literally introduced this to us by him being like, oh, without my costume, I feel impotent, and then making it like,
yes,
literally about sex in that moment. And I just couldn't, I can't do this. I can't do this with you.
I cannot.
The best thing that I can see is that the level of privilege that Batman would have would make him a pretty crappy superhero in the long run. But like, I don't know if that discussion of privilege was happening as much back then. You know what I mean? Like, Moore was like 30 years ahead of his time. I don't know.
That's the kind of thing that I do think is really interesting about this book, and that why I come away from it with this sense of, I'm pretty sure I didn't like it, but I am glad that I read it. Because I think stuff like that is the starting point in the book for a more interesting conversation that the book doesn't actually have, but like the book can be used as a jumping off point for.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate that. Something less significant, but all of John's like struggling to connect, I thought was fairly well done. I enjoyed that as a concept, and it reminded me a lot of the Game of Thrones show. I don't know, like the book hasn't gotten this far in Bran's story, so unclear how that will be handled there, but like it reminded me a lot of like what the show wanted to do with Bran, but like never, because this is also why Bran is like, I don't know, kind of a sociopath, right? Is that like he's processing all of this knowledge at once, and like his sense of time is now broken, but on the show it was just like really flat and weird. I was struck by how much more interesting the blue guy was as a like representation of this idea.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Yeah, he's a much better Bran.
Yes.
I want some really talented visual effects guy to just like home edit Dr. Manhattan in as Bran in Game of Thrones.
Improvement.
Oh, so much better.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you all for listening. Thank you so much to Garrett for answering the call on Twitter and joining us this week. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would love it if you consider joining our community on Patreon at patreon.com/SnarkSquad, or left us a rating or review in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or shared it with your friends. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on SnarkSquad.com, or you can find us all on Twitter at @Snark_Squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name is Muddiness.
And you can find me at underrealm.net.
Thank you, as always, to Stephen Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now, and we will be back in your feed again next week. Bye!
Bye.